Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is legendary photographer Alan Dines, and we are talking about his new memoir, Front Row Center, How I Met Everyone. Alan, welcome to the show. It's such a pleasure to talk to you.
Mark, thanks for having me on.
This is, I mentioned to you this off mic, but I mean this. I hope this is only part one, because I know you have more photographs and more stories.
I do have both, and the title will probably be And How I Met Everyone Else.
Now, I got to ask you, how did you, and this is told in the book, how did you start photography? Like, was that your road in life originally?
Oh, my God, no. I had about 50 other jobs prior to that. The last one and the longest one was working with my dad selling sharpening stones to half of the NHL.
Wow. So what? And the story's in the book, but and I find this really great and amazing. So what finally pushed you into photography?
It was getting a camera for my trip with my wife when we got married. We honeymooned in Greece, and my brothers got us an Olympus. I don't believe she ever touched it even once, but I certainly had a lot of fun with it.
And then you knew that's what you wanted to do for your life's work.
No, it actually took a while to grow. It was probably about 2 years from the time that I took that first photo, on the honeymoon in 1990 till 92 when I attended the Eyeball, which was the first event that meant anything. But those 2 years was learning the craft. I was working with my dad. He was giving me the freedom to go out and just practice and shoot. And I did lessons that were in magazines at the time.
Oh, my God. So you basically are self-taught.
I am self-taught all the way up through digital. I had nobody to teach me this stuff. I was on my own.
You don't really need to be taught digital.
Well,
you're shooting. In this book, you're shooting, and it's really important for people to know this, you're shooting old style.
I am. I would say probably 99% of the book is all film, and a good portion of it I processed myself in my little bathroom, darkroom.
Oh, wow. People who've never, I'm older than you, Alan, and people who don't know what it's like to develop your own photographs, that's a magical process.
It's not only a magical process, I think that's a great way to say it. It's still magic to me now, but it was even made more so by the fact of what I was seeing coming up in the trays
yeah.
that I was developing. The first thing is that you're nervous as all get out while you're just developing the roll, taking it out of the camera and loading it onto a spool just to develop the negatives. I mean, it's a long process, and until it comes out of there and you fixed it and you're looking at it, you really had no idea what you had. You had hoped that you did everything right, but you didn't know until you saw that roll of negatives drying from your rack.
Yeah, and people also got to realize that you're bringing film, which means you can't just take an infinite number of photographs.
No, and it's funny you should say that, because I had clients all the time. You know, the way I would bill them is I would bill them per roll. So client with a little bit of money would say, you know, shoot a roll or two. And I'm like, you know, I'd really rather shoot three or four, but they're paying for it. And so that happened a lot of time. I even limited myself when I would go out, if it was a pro bono or a discounted nonprofit, I would absolutely limit the amount of rolls that I would shoot. I did not have unlimited funds, and it costs a lot. But if you want to know the funny thing, Mark, right now to take that same 36 images and bring it somewhere to print it costs more than it cost me originally to do it.
To print the digital.
To print, if I took that roll of film.
Oh, right, because there's no more, it's not done anymore.
Right. There are very few places that do it, and it does get to be expensive, so I do that myself.
Now, your first paying job was, and in the book, there was a father-daughter situation. The father wanted a photograph of his daughter. You did it. And I think you got paid the princely sum of $20.
No, 10.
Whoa!
$10.
Still, it's $10 for something that you did.
Absolutely. And you know what you had asked earlier, you know, what kind of set me on the path? Well, that was the moment when he said, you know, you could take a photo of my daughter, which I asked for permission for. She was a youngster. And he said, but you have to let me buy one. And that wow. was what wow. did it for me. You know, I had finally developed this passion for it. I was learning. This was part of a lesson from one of the magazines to just go out and photograph children doing stuff.
Yep.
And then getting paid for it was just, that was awesome.
Now, at the peak of in this book, what kind of camera are you using? What are you shooting?
I've always shot Nikon.
Okay.
And honestly, again, because I was, you know, I was paying for all this on my own, I typically was one level of camera behind everybody else. It's true to this day, but I just never felt the need to move into the much more expensive cameras. But yeah, I was always a little bit under equipped and knew it when I went out.
Well, I want to ask you about that because you don't go into details in the book, but you're going to all these incredible shoots, like at the Hat Shell, at all these different concerts. What are you carrying physically on your body? I know you're carrying the camera. You're carrying a bunch of lenses. Are you carrying a lot of film? What are you carrying?
Typically for the large concerts, I had an assistant who was actually my brother as well, which was really wonderful. We spent, as I say in the book, we traveled miles and miles together, and he always had my back. He would carry the bag. He would carry the film if it was, you know, it needed to be numbered so I knew when it was shot. There was no timestamp on the images back then. So he was my carrier. He had everything, and if I needed a lens, I would just ask him to change it out, and he would do that. And then at other shows, typically it was a strobo frame, which basically separates a flash from the camera, an extra battery to charge everything, the camera, and that's about it. I would carry a second lens usually around my waist, but wherever I worked, since I was the photographer of the venue, let's say, there was always a place for me to leave my bag. And honestly, in 30 years, I never had a single thing taken.
That is amazing, actually. That's the most amazing thing in the book. Oh, my God. Now, was Joan Rivers your first real celebrity that you shot?
I would say, you know, aside from the local celebrities, like, you know,
Norm Nathan and stuff like that.
Right. But he not national. Yeah. Joan would be the first person that I knew from TV. And yeah, my knees were a little bit knocking that day. For sure.
Well, this is what I want to ask you, Alan. There are so many adventures of you and mega celebrities in this book. How did you learn to be comfortable around celebrity? And like, how did you learn, like, what was the point where I could push it a little bit to get the shot and when to back down? Was that a learning curve for you?
It is, but I didn't always learn it. There were certainly times where, you know, you interrupted somebody for a photo at the wrong time, or they're in the middle of something. That was few and far between. I did kind of know what I was doing, but as far as the first part of your question about being you know, able to approach them, I was 30 when I became a photographer. I wasn't 20, 21, 22. I had jobs, having sold sharpening stones to most of the NHL. I met people like Ray Bourque and Cam Neely and all the guys from the Bruins. So they were, you know, they were a step up in celebrity, and I just learned that, you know, you don't have time to be nervous. You have a job to do. I have a job to do, and I need to make sure I do my job right. And I really, there were not many times where celebrity actually got to me, but one of them, and probably the one that I talk about most, is being in the studio at Greater Media on Morrissey Boulevard with James Taylor, him and his guitar.
Wow.
I've said it before. I didn't know knees could knock when you're sitting on the ground.
Well, there are so many amazing stories, and I want to talk about some of them. The ZLX-B in summer of 1993, the band, the Birds, Duke and the Drivers. This was at the Memorial Shell in Charles River?
Yeah. It was.
I grew up in Watertown, so I used to hang around there all the time.
Sure.
So that sounds like a mega event. What, of those groups, what was your favorite to photograph?
Well, the band was the big name that day.
Yeah,
And being behind him on the stage while he's playing drums.
Oh my God.
That was pretty unreal. And that was, I talked about it in the book as well. That was the first time that I was on a stage looking out in an audience. And that's an incredible feeling.
I love how you talk about the miracle of all access passes. And by the way, the cover of the book, the back cover of the book is just splattered with your all access passes. But those are great to have. Those must be amazing.
It's fun to have them and to have a pass. And I say this all the time. If anybody ever tells you that having an all access pass isn't thrilling, then they shouldn't be doing what they're doing anymore. It never gets old. It does not get old.
Now, this book is chock full of photographs, and it'll take you a long time to get over them and to look at them. But there's some photographs that are really weird, and I got to ask you about this one. There's a photograph of Chuck Nolan and a tortoise.
Yeah, that was.
What the hell's going on there?
Well, again, this is the being, and you know, it's very relaxed. The DJs at ZLX were fabulous. Ken Shelton was there as well, and I just saw him last night at an event at the Regent. What happened was they had, I think it was the tide pool exhibit from the aquarium. And Chuck knows that I'm working for the station. He sees the pass. We had done something on stage. And I just asked him as we're walking around, because part of my job was not only to get the celebrities, but to show basically the flow of the day, show the crowds, the audience, the demographics, which was really important to them. And to their sponsors, and to show everybody that was sponsored in the tents at the very back of the green area in front of the shell. And I said to Chuck, I said, you want to walk around and have some fun? And he did. But I have to tell you, the tortoise isn't the weirdest one that he did. He went nose to nose with I think it was a python. I really don't know. It was some big snake. I didn't even want to get close with my camera. And he had it wrapped around his
neck. Oh, whoa. Do you have a photograph of that?
I do. I do. I don't think it was one of my better ones. I really like the one where he's nose to nose.
Oh, that's a great photo. That's a fantastic photograph. Well, one of the things, the great things in this book is to track your career, because you built your career the old-fashioned way. You would make a connection. You do the business. You shine in doing it. And then you make connections and then more and more connections. And there are certain places in Boston that you obviously, like the House of Blues is a place that you shot in a lot, isn't it?
I shot at the House of Blues for 2.5 years. I wasn't there. I was there for the opening while I was working for the newspaper. I did the opening. Then I didn't have connection with them for almost 8 or 9 months. And it was actually the Bean that made that connection possible. The House of Blues had the House of Blues All-Stars playing that day. And I was approached by a gentleman named Nigel Shanley from the House of Blues, and who said to me, you know, we'd like to get copies of those. It was Monster Mike,
yep.
Mike Ford, and some of the other people that were local blues guys. And I was old enough at that time, as I said, I was 30. I knew not to just send the photos to him. If I did, that would have been the end of that. What I actually did was I said, I'd be happy to share them with you. I'll bring them into you the following week. And I did go into them the following week, and I had already produced basically a photo album for WZLX to bring out to their sponsors with photos from the BN. I showed it to him, and literally within 5 minutes, he had gone into a back office, came back up, and hired me for that next Thursday to shoot an event at the House of Blues. And that was the start of it. And then for 2.5 years, I was front and center for, God, maybe 100 shows. It was just incredible.
Are there certain, whenever you have a venue like that, do you search out the place to be to get the perfect shot? I mean, do you have to sort of case the joint in order to figure out where's the best place I'm going to stand? That can't be always front and center.
It isn't, and that's exactly correct. At least for me, whenever I got to a venue, first of all, I was always early. I was never on time. I was always early.
Right.
It was for exactly that reason, to store my gear, to talk to the client, see if there's any changes, and certainly walk around the venue, see where glasses, where mirrors are, where I might be able to get a better vantage point. And it's funny, one of the things I learned at the House of Blues, and it took a little while, was I did like to shoot from the soundboard, but the soundboard was upstairs and all the way back from the stage at the other end. And so the first few times that I shot there, I went up to the green room when it was appropriate and did some photos from up there with the flash and got my negatives back. And there was a line across the stage, halfway down the stage. And I couldn't figure it out. I thought I had issues with the camera and went out and shot it again. And sure enough, there was that line. And I still couldn't figure it out. So the third time I went back, I went back with one of my prints to see what could be doing it. And it happens that there was a bar, a metal bar, to support some lights halfway back from the stage. And my flash would hit that and then throw this dark line across
wow.
the stage.
Wow.
So what I learned, it took a while to learn that, but learning the fix was real simple. And the sound guy, Chris, who was up there, like, looked at me and laughed. But what I did was, I turned my entire camera and flash upside down from the soundboard, so now the flash is below the camera, not above it, and below the bar. And sure enough, when I shot it like that, there was no line on the stage, and that became the way I shot from the soundboard every single time.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is legendary photographer Alan Dines, and we're talking about his new memoir, Front Row Center: How I Met Everyone. This is a case where the title doesn't lie. There are so many people in this book, it's sort of mind-boggling. So I'm just going to pick a couple of my favorite ones. Peter Wolf. The Jay Giles Band, when I was a kid and I went to Clark University here, they used to come up and play Clark's bar, then go over and play WPI's frat house. And it was amazing to be able to see a band like that. But you got great shots of Peter Wolf, and they actually made the Boston Herald.
They did, and it was the first shot that I ever had in a major paper. You know, I had previous shots in the Jewish Advocate. I shot them for over a year and did, you know, the front page, but it wasn't celebrity. But once I was working at the House of Blues, it wasn't long before I got a call one night at 11:30. I was literally getting ready for bed in Somerville, and I was told, can you be down here in half an hour? Peter Wolf is going to jump up on stage with Ron Golub and some of the guys from Rod Stewart's band who had played, I believe they were at the maybe the Harbor Lights Pavilion that night. And I said, sure. And the hardest thing was finding parking at that hour in Harvard Square to be able to get there on time. But it all worked out. Got a great shot. Heard some fabulous music, and I've been a fan of the Jay Giles Band since I was a kid. So photograph Peter and have that be the first shot in a major paper was really exciting.
By the way, thanks to your book, I had totally forgotten that he had been married to Faye Dunaway. And it wasn't...
That's right.
That was long ago and far away, and luckily your book brought it up. There's a really great story about shooting Aaron Neville. Can you talk about that?
Sure.
That's the one where he didn't have to smile and he was happy.
Right, exactly. That's exactly right. This was a mixed fest, fall fest on the Boston Common, and Aaron Neville was there. There was also Gloria. I'm forgetting her name at the moment. There are a lot of names, so forgive me if I miss a name. But Aaron was the big one. Alita Adams was another performer that day. So I'm backstage. Actually, I was there to shoot for Wingo, which was a Boston Herald theme years ago.
I remember that. Oh, my God.
Yeah. They had the card, and everybody would hold them up. The other person was Laura Branigan. That's who I was thinking of.
Right.
And so I was there to shoot, you know, celebrities holding up the Wingo card. And I also had, again, I had a pass, so I was able to walk around, and I was backstage. I saw Alita come off the stage, and she got a big hug from Aaron. So I did a couple of shots of them. And again, you're wearing a pass, you have a camera, This is pre-digital, so there are no phones up in the air taking pictures. I was the only one backstage with a camera, so I became very important because of that, aside from the past. And people would afford me that privilege of knowing that, well, if you're back here with the pass and a camera, you know, you're the person to be smiling at. So Aaron, you know, smiled with Alita, and then he went into, after they separated, he went into a tent. He did some more signing. And then I went in and found us alone in the tent. And I, you know, gave him a few minutes. He saw them standing there. He finishes what he's doing, kind of puts his head down, and then I asked him if he would mind doing one more photo. And, you know, kind of like a sigh comes out of him, and he lifts up his head, and he starts smiling. And I just knew it was not right at that time, and I just said, Aaron, one last thing. And he looks at me and just goes, what, man? I said, lose the smile. And his face changed. I mean, it just,
wow,
it just absolutely changed in that fraction of a second. And he said to me, thanks, man. I'm tired of all this. And he showed, like, you know, the smile on his face. And he, like I said, he dropped the smile. Attitude changed. I think I shot all of 2 shots at that very moment, and that was it. And one of them made the book. And one of my favorite shots, certainly one of my favorite early shots. But I do want to point out that the whole book, and I think you'll attest to this, Mark, it's about nostalgia. Yeah, it's my career, and it's meeting all these people, but it's nostalgia for anybody that went to shows in the 90s. You were 10, 20, or 30 in the 90s. You were going to the Hat Shell, the 4th of July, the Harbor Lights Pavilion, the Tweeter Center, the Garden, the Rat. You know, you were going to these places, and these stories are going to make you remember that. And I hope I accomplished that with your read as well.
Yeah, you know, and you recall there's a summer concert. I think it's in front of the City Hall.
Yeah,
that's like an oven.
It's right. Oh yeah, that was the oldies before they moved to the Hat Shell. It was another client I worked for the oldie station for many years, and great DJs, just fun shows. And my favorite was when Frankie Valli played.
They had
6,000 people, and you could see literally from standing at the stairs at Government Center, you could see the crowds coming across underneath the expressway, which was raised at that time still, for those that don't remember, coming across from the North End with their chairs and drinks and bags. It was just amazing.
Well, you got a rooftop shot there, didn't you?
I did. I've never had a fear of heights as long as I'm stable. So if I'm on a building, I'm good. You know, a tree less so, and parasailing even less so. But, you know, standing on top of a building that I know is not going anywhere, I'm pretty brave. And I did enjoy shooting crowd shots, not only there, but I've been to the top of 1 Beacon Street, which used to be owned by Emerson College, and that was an overlook to the Hat Shell. And I have photos, you know, of the full,
wow,
the shell and all the people in front from that building as well. I never touched in the book about working at Massport, really. I worked in Massport for almost 10 years as well, and used to go up on the, I call them Imperial Walkers, those big things at Conley Terminal.
Yeah.
That bring up the containers off the ship, dangling my feet over the edge, getting shots of the city in the boats. I called it my happy place.
I got to talk to you. You got to tell a story of Heidi's picture with Davy Jones of the Monkees.
Well, for those that don't know, in the
oh, come on,
Heidi is my wife. What's really interesting is we've actually known each other since we were children in Montreal. My mom and her mom were in nursing school together, nice. So we've literally known each other our whole lives. And what made it so funny is that, you know, she was coming to the shows and sitting in the audience, and we would do our date nights, which would be after the show, we'd go out and have dinner. And it never crossed my mind that she had never met celebrities.
Wow.
You know, she had been to some of these shows, but in her life, she had really never met celebrities. And so while it was, you know, day in and day out for me, pretty much, it was really, really new for her. And the funniest part about meeting Davy Jones was that she didn't care about him from the Monkees at all. she cared about him and wanted the photo because he had been on the Brady Bunch.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah. And so we do have that photo, and it's one of my favorites of her, and she just looks so happy with Davey.
Well, first of all, the list of bands and people in this book are frighteningly long and bizarre and wild. Gary Lewis and the Playboys, Paul Revere and the Raiders, Lou Christie, which, boy, I didn't hear Lou Christie's name in a while. Lightning Strikes Again. Freddie right. Boom Boom Cannon, Little Anthony and the Imperials, Carl Perkins. Great photos of Carl Perkins.
Carl Perkins was awesome. I mean, for those that don't know, he wrote Blue Suede Shoes, which Elvis eventually made super famous, but he was wearing his blue shoes that day. And he was just a very kind, very quiet guy. And after the event, I did want to get an autograph. And when I had the opportunity, as I say, I really did enjoy getting autographs on my own images. I mean, I found that exciting and have most of them still. And I sent, typically when I did that, I would send out two. I would send out one to get autographed and have them send back. And the second one would be for them to keep, whether they needed them or not. At least I knew I had done something nice back to them in asking for the autograph. And Carl Perkins wrote on mine probably the strangest that I ever got. He wrote, "Great photo, poor subject, your friend, Carl Perkins."
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, we're just about out of time. And there's so many more stories in this book. You can see Matthew Perry in a Zamboni. You can see the Dalai Lama. You can find out how Alan pissed off a legend. And he did, which, buy the book to find out. My guest tonight has been legendary photographer Alan Dines. And we've been talking about his new memoir. Hopefully it's only volume one. Front Row Center, How I Met Everyone. Alan, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much. And that can be ordered both through Amazon and my website, alandinesphotography.com. And that one will be signed.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.